Chapter 86. Had she not better stay with you? ... returns the bridegroom. I think not, my dear Domini. No, I think not. I shall be better alone. Besides, my dearest Edith will be her natural and constant guardian when you return, and I had better not encroach upon her trust, perhaps. She might be jealous. Eh, dear Edith? ... The affectionate mama presses her daughter's arm, as she says this, perhaps entreating her attention earnestly. To be serious, my dear Domini, ... she resumes, I will relinquish our dear child, and not inflict my gloom upon her. We have settled that, just now. She fully understands, dear Domini. Edith, my dear, she fully understands. ... Again, the good mother presses her daughter's arm. Mr. Domini offers no additional remonstrance, for the clergyman and clerk appear, and Mrs. Miff, and Mr. Sounds the beadle, group the party in their proper places at the altar rails. The sun is shining down upon the golden letters of the Ten Commandments. Why does the bride's eye read them, one by one? Which one of all the ten appears the plainest to her in the glare of light? False gods, murder, theft, the honor that she owes her mother, which is it that appears to leave the wall, and printing itself in glowing letters, on her book? Who giveth this woman, to be married to this man? ... Cousin Phoenix does that. He has come from Baden-Baden on purpose. Confound it, ... Cousin Phoenix says, good-natured creature. Cousin Phoenix, when we do get a rich city fellow into the family, let us show him some attention. Let us do something for him. ... I give this woman, to be married to this man. ... Saith Cousin Phoenix therefore. Cousin Phoenix, meaning to go in a straight line, but turning off sideways by reason of his willful legs, gives the wrong woman, to be married to this man, at first to wit, a bridesmaid of some condition, distantly connected with the family, and 10 years Mrs. Scutons Jr. But Mrs. Miff, interposing her mortified bonnet, dexterously turns him back, and runs him, as on casters, full at the good lady, whom Cousin Phoenix giveth to married to this man accordingly. And will they in the sight of heaven? Eh, that they will. Mr. Domini says he will. And what says Edith? She will. So, from that day forward, for better for worse, for richer for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish, till death do them part, they plight their troth to one another, and are married. In a firm, free hand, the bride subscribes her name in the register, when they adjourn to the vestry. There ain't a many ladies come here, ... Mrs. Miff says with a curtsy, to look at Mrs. Miff, at such a season, is to make her mortified bonnet go down with a dip, writes their names like this good lady. ... Mr. Sounds the beadle thinks it is a truly spanking signature, and worthy of the writer this, however, between himself and conscience. Florence signs too, but unapplauded, for her hand shakes. All the party sign, Cousin Phoenix last, who puts his noble name into a wrong place, and enrolls himself as having been born that morning. The major now salutes the bride right gallantly, and carries out that branch of military tactics in reference to all the ladies. Notwithstanding Mrs. Scutons being extremely hard to kiss, and squeaking shrilly in the sacred edifice, the example is followed by Cousin Phoenix and even by Mr. Domini. Lastly, Mr. Carker, with his white teeth glistening, approaches Edith, more as if he meant to bite her than to taste the sweets that linger on her lips. There is a glow upon her proud cheek, and a flashing in her eyes, that may be meant to stay him, but it does not, for he salutes her as the rest have done, and wishes her all happiness. If wishes, ... says he in a low voice, are not superfluous, applied to such a union. ... I thank you, sir, ... she answers, with a curled lip, and a heaving bosom. But, does Edith feel still, as on the night, when she knew that Mr. Domini would return to offer his alliance, that Carker knows her thoroughly, and reads her right, and that she is more degraded by his knowledge of her than by aught else? Is it for this reason that her haughtiness shrinks beneath his smile, like snow within the hands that grasps it firmly, and that her imperious glance droops in meeting his, and seeks the ground? I am proud to see, apostrophe said Mr. Carker, with a servile stooping of his neck, which the revelations making by his eyes and teeth proclaim to be a lie, I am proud to see, that my humble offering is graced by Mrs. Dombey's hand, and permitted to hold so favored a place in, so joyful an occasion. Apostrophe, though she bends her head, in answer, there is something in the momentary action of her hand, as if she would crush the flowers it holds, and fling them, with contempt, upon the ground. But, she puts the hand through the arm of her new husband, who has been standing near, conversing with the major, and is proud again, and motionless, and silent. The carriages are once more at the church door. Mr. Dombey, with his bride upon his arm, conducts her through the 20 families of little women who are on the steps, and every one of whom remembers the fashion and the color of her every article of dress from that moment, and reproduces it on her doll, who is forever being married. Cleopatra and Cousin Phoenix enter the same carriage. The major hands into a second carriage, Florence, and the bridesmaid who so narrowly escaped, being given away by mistake, and then enters it himself, and is followed by Mr. Carker. Horses prance and caper, coachmen and footmen shine in fluttering favors, flowers, and new-made liveries. Away they dash, and rattle through the streets, and as they pass along, a thousand heads are turned to look at them, and a thousand sober moralists revenge themselves for not being married to, that morning, by reflecting that these people little think such happiness can last. Miss Tox emerges from behind the cherubim's leg, when all is quiet, and comes slowly down from the gallery. Miss Tox's eyes are red, and her pocket handkerchief is damp. She is wounded, but not exasperated, and she hopes they may be happy. She quite admits to herself the beauty of the bride, and her own comparatively feeble and faded attractions, but the stately image of Mr. Dombey in his lilac waistcoat, and his fawn-colored pantaloons, is present to her mind, and Miss Tox weeps afresh, behind her veil, on her way home to Princess's Place. Captain Cuttle, having joined in all the amens and responses, with a devout growl, feels much improved by his religious exercises, and in a peaceful frame of mind pervades the body of the church, glazed hat in hand, and reads the tablet to the memory of little Paul. The gallant Mr. Toots, attended by the faithful Chicken, leaves the building in torments of love. The Chicken is as yet unable to elaborate a scheme for winning Florence, but his first idea has gained possession of him, and he thinks the doubling up of Mr. Dombey would be a move in the right direction. Mr. Dombey's servants come out of their hiding places, and prepare to rush to Brook Street, when they are delayed by symptoms of indisposition on the part of Mrs. Perch, who entreats a glass of water, and becomes alarming. Mrs. Perch gets better soon, however, and is borne away, and Mrs. Miff, and Mr. Sounds the Beadle, sit upon the steps, to count what they have gained by the affair, and talk it over, while the sexton tolls a funeral. Now, the carriages arrive at the bride's residence, and the players on the bells begin to jingle, and the band strikes up, and Mr. Punch, that model of connubial bliss, salutes his wife. Now, the people run, and push, and press round in a gaping throng, while Mr. Dombey, leading Mrs. Dombey by the hand, advances solemnly into the Phoenix Halls. Now, the rest of the wedding party alight, and enter after them. And why does Mr. Carker, passing through the people to the hall door, think of the old woman who called to him in the grove that morning? Or why does Florence, as she passes, think, with a tremble, of her childhood, when she was lost, and of the visage of good Mrs. Brown? Now, there are more congratulations on this happiest of days, and more company, though not much, And now they leave the drawing room, and range themselves at table in the dark brown dining room, which no confectioner can brighten up. Let him garnish the exhausted negroes with as many flowers and love nuts as he will. The pastry cook has done his duty like a man, though, and a rich breakfast is set forth. Mr. and Mrs. Chick have joined the party, among others. Mrs. Chick admires that Edith should be, by nature, such a perfect dominie, and is affable and confidential to Mrs. Skewton, whose mind is relieved of a great load, and who takes her share of the champagne. The very tall young man who suffered from excitement early is better, but a vague sentiment of repentance has seized upon him, and he hates the other very tall young man, and wrests dishes from him by violence, and takes a grim delight in disobliging the company. The company are cool and calm, and do not outrage the black hatchments of pictures looking down upon them, by any excess of mirth. Cousin Phoenix and the Major are the gayest there, but Mr. Carker has a smile for the whole table. He has an especial smile for the bride, who very, very seldom meets it. Cousin Phoenix rises, when the company have breakfasted, and the servants have left the room. And wonderfully young he looks, with his white wristbands almost covering his hands, otherwise rather bony, and the bloom of the champagne in his cheeks. Upon my honor, apostrophe says Cousin Phoenix, although it's an unusual sort of thing in a private gentleman's house, I must beg leave to call upon you to drink what is usually called a in fact a toast. The Major very hoarsely indicates his approval. Mr. Carker, bending his head forward over the table in the direction of Cousin Phoenix, smiles and nods a great many times. In fact, it's not a apostrophe Cousin Phoenix beginning again, thus, comes to a dead stop. Here, here. Apostrophe, apostrophe says the Major, in a tone of conviction. Mr. Carker softly claps his hands, and bending forward over the table again, smiles and nods a great many more times than before, as if he were particularly struck by this last observation, and desired personally to express his sense of the good it has done. It is, apostrophe says Cousin Phoenix, an occasion in fact, when the general usages of life may be a little departed from, without impropriety. And although I never was an orator in my life, and when I was in the House of Commons, and had the honor of seconding the address, was laid up for a fortnight with the consciousness of failure, apostrophe, the Major and Mr. Carker are so much delighted by this fragment of personal history, that Cousin Phoenix laughs, and addressing them individually, goes on to say, and in point of fact, when I was devilish ill still, you know, I feel that a duty devolves upon me. And when a duty devolves upon an Englishman, he is bound to get out of it, in my opinion, in the best way he can. Well, our family has had the gratification, today, of connecting itself, in the person of my lovely and accomplished relative, whom I now see in point of fact. Present apostrophe, here there is general applause. Present apostrophe repeats Cousin Phoenix, feeling that it is a neat point which will bear repetition, with one who that is to say, with a man, at whom the finger of scorn can never in fact, with my honorable friend Domini, if he will allow me to call him so. Apostrophe, Cousin Phoenix bows to Mr. Domini. Mr. Domini solemnly returns the bow. Everybody is more or less gratified and affected by this extraordinary, and perhaps unprecedented, appeal to the feelings. I have not, apostrophe says Cousin Phoenix, enjoyed those opportunities which I could have desired, of cultivating the acquaintance of my friend Domini, and studying those qualities which do equal honor to his head, and, in point of fact, to his heart. For it has been my misfortune to be, as we used to say in my time in the House of Commons, when it was not the custom, to allude to the Lords, and when the order of parliamentary proceedings was perhaps better observed than it is now to be in point of fact, apostrophe says Cousin Phoenix, cherishing his joke, with great slyness, and finally bringing it out with a jerk, in another place. Apostrophe, the Major falls into convulsions, and is recovered with difficulty. But I know sufficient of my friend Domini, apostrophe resumes Cousin Phoenix in a graver tone, as if he had suddenly become a sadder and wiser man, to know that he is, in point of fact, what may be emphatically called a merchant, a British merchant and a man. And although I have been resident abroad for some years, it would give me great pleasure to receive my friend Domini and everybody here at Baden-Baden, and to have an opportunity of making him known to the Grand Duke. Still, I know enough, I flatter myself, of my lovely and accomplished relative to know that she possesses every requisite to make a man happy, and that her marriage with my friend Domini is one of inclination and affection on both sides. Apostrophe, many smiles and nods from Mr. Carker. Therefore, apostrophe, says Cousin Phoenix, I congratulate the family of which I am a member on the acquisition of my friend Domini. I congratulate my friend Domini on his union with my lovely and accomplished relative who possesses every requisite to make a man happy, and I take the liberty of calling on you all, in point of fact, to congratulate both my friend Domini and my lovely and accomplished relative on the present occasion. Apostrophe, the speech of Cousin Phoenix is received with great applause, and Mr. Domini returns thanks on behalf of himself and Mrs. Domini. J. B. shortly afterwards proposes Mrs. Skewton. The breakfast languishes. When that is done, the violated hatchments are avenged, and Edith rises to assume her traveling dress. All the servants in the meantime have been breakfasting below. Champagne has grown too common among them to be mentioned, and roast fowls, raised pies, and lobster salad have become mere drugs. The very tall young man has recovered his spirits, and again alludes to the exciseman. His comrade's eye begins to emulate his own, and he too stares at objects without taking cognizance thereof. There is a general redness in the faces of the ladies, in the face of Mrs. Perch particularly, who is joyous and beaming, and lifted so far above the cares of life, that if she were asked just now to direct a wayfarer to Ball's Pond, where her own cares lodge, she would have some difficulty in recalling the way. Mr. Towlinson has proposed the happy pair, to which the silver-headed butler has responded neatly and with emotion, for he half begins to think he is an old retainer of the family, and that he is bound to be affected by these changes. The whole party, and especially the ladies, are very frolicsome. Mr. Domini's cook, who generally takes the lead in society, has said, it is impossible to settle down after this, and why not go, in a party, to the play? Everybody, Mrs. Perch included, has agreed to this. Even the native, who is tigerish in his drink, and who alarms the ladies, Mrs. Perch particularly, by the rolling of his eyes. One of the very tall young men has even proposed a ball after the play, and it presents itself to no one, Mrs. Perch included, in the light of an impossibility. Words have arisen between the housemaid and Mr. Towlinson. She, on the authority of an old saw, asserting marriages to be made in heaven. He, affecting to trace the manufacture elsewhere. He, supposing that she says so, because she thinks of being married her own self. She, saying, Lord forbid, at any rate, that she should ever marry him. To calm these flying taunts, the silver-headed butler rises to propose the health of Mr. Towlinson, whom to know is to esteem, and to esteem is to wish well settled in life with the object of his choice, wherever here the silver-headed butler eyes the housemaid, she may be. Mr. Towlinson returns thanks in a speech replete with feeling, of which the peroration turns on foreigners, regarding whom he says they may find favor, sometimes, with weak and inconstant intellects that can be led away by hair, but all he hopes is, he may never hear of no foreigner never boning nothing out of no traveling chariot. The eye of Mr. Towlinson is so severe and so expressive here that the housemaid is turning hysterical when she and all the rest, roused by the intelligence that the bride is going away, hurry upstairs to witness her departure. The chariot is at the door. The bride is descending to the hall. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.